everybody, and welcome back to Fueling Forward Friday. I'm your host, Maddie Alm, registered dietitian and former elite runner. Today's episode, I will be answering questions you all have submitted to me beforehand. And if you would like to submit any questions in the future, you can do so at my website, www.fuelingforward.com, under the podcast tab, or you can send me an email at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. I hope you enjoy today's episode. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Fueling Forward podcast. I'm so excited that you're here. Happy Friday. We did it. We made it through the week. I'm really excited for today's episode. I've been getting so many great questions from all of you and really appreciate everyone who has taken the time to write in. Definitely going to do my best to get through everything. And I've even had some overlapping questions, which I love because I always tell people, you know, they'll say, oh, this is a stupid question, but, and I'm like, no, there's no such thing as a stupid question, because I promise if you have that question, there is somebody else who also has that question. So there is no question too big or too small to write in with. Please keep them coming. I'm really enjoying reading them. So before I get into today's episode, there's a couple things I wanted to touch on. The first, just sort of some like housekeeping, Fueling Forward announcements. I did want to mention that I have some one-on-one nutrition coaching spots opening up in March. So if you've ever been interested in working with a dietitian or working with me specifically, you can head to my website and there's some information on there about what that would look like. You can also apply and schedule a free exploratory call over Zoom. And those calls are really just so we can meet, you can get a feel for me, what the program looks like, what kind of work we would be doing. There's no pressure to commit to anything. I just find that it's best if we can meet before you have to make that decision to move forward with working with me. So if you're interested in that, feel free to head over to my website and learn more about that. The next thing I wanted to talk about before I start answering questions is that this is National Eating Disorder Awareness Week. So I wanted to start today's episode with just some facts and figures about the prevalence of eating disorders in athletes specifically. And it is a population that tends to be disproportionately affected by eating disorders. So we have seen in research, and more recent research has been showing even higher numbers than what we used to think, but it's estimated that up to 45% of female athletes and up to 20% of male athletes are struggling with an eating disorder. And up to 85% of collegiate athletes have displayed some type of disordered eating behavior. So over half of collegiate athletes are affected by struggling with their relationship with food and or body image. And that's huge. That's more likely than not that somebody listening to this podcast is in a place where they're struggling. And so I just wanted to take a minute to kind of break down what that means and what you can do to seek some help or find some support. I also wanted to mention that there is sort of a spectrum. So eating disorders and disordered eating are different things, although in my opinion, they're just as serious. So everybody who has an eating disorder also has disordered eating, but not everybody who has disordered eating has an eating disorder. So it's a little bit confusing. The biggest difference is just the diagnostic criteria. So eating disorders are mental illnesses. They are classified as mental disorders in the DSM-5. So that's the manual that's used by psychologists, psychiatrists to diagnose people with mental illness. And since it's a medical diagnosis, there are criteria from a medical standpoint that somebody has to meet in order to receive an eating disorder diagnosis. And there's been a lot of push to try to change those criteria, especially when it comes to things like anorexia, which is where you're restricting food intake. Previously, the DSM-5 said that you had to have a certain amount of weight loss to meet that criteria. We now have a new diagnosis called atypical anorexia, which is when we see all the signs of anorexia independent of weight changes. So I think it's important to understand that it doesn't have to result in weight loss or somebody looking really unhealthy. There is no one size or shape or look for eating disorders. So that can be tricky, I think, when athletes are struggling and they try to get help. and they're told they're not, quote unquote, sick enough to get a diagnosis, which, of course, with our current health care system, it's so difficult to even get things reimbursed, get insurance to cover things, especially without that clinical diagnosis. So that's really the main difference between the two, is just the clinical severity. And typically an eating disorder is disordered eating that's gotten to the point that it's negatively impacting health. And eating disorders are actually the number one deadliest mental illness. They result in the most deaths because anorexia specifically impacts heart tissue, heart muscle, electrolyte imbalances, and typically leads to things like cardiac events. So they're very serious. And yes, you know, it is important to distinguish between somebody who's in a state of potentially medical crisis, who needs medical intervention, and somebody who might be considered lower risk. But I do think that I want to validate anyone who is struggling or who maybe doesn't think that they have an eating disorder. You may not meet that criteria, but that doesn't mean that your struggles aren't valid and that you should not be seeking help. And also, I wanted to point out that there is a really high percentage of former athletes who struggle with disordered eating behavior. It's estimated that 42 to 65% of retired athletes engage in some type of disordered eating behavior. So again, really, really relevant in this population. And something that I've touched on before, but haven't really talked about on this podcast, is something called REDS, or Red S, which is relative energy deficiency in sport. And this is basically when there's a mismatch between how much energy your body is requiring to function and support your training and what you're putting back into your body with food. And it's very prevalent to struggle with this, to have a discrepancy. And this discrepancy can happen whether or not it's intentional. So I see a lot of young athletes, especially student athletes, struggling with symptoms of REDS because it can just be so difficult to eat enough and hit their fueling needs in a day, especially when you're on campus all day or you're away from home, you're sitting in classes all day. It can just be really difficult. But there is often an intentional component, and it can start out well-meaning, right? An athlete who is just thinking, I'm going to start paying more attention to what I'm eating in the hopes that it's going to make me a better athlete. And this is where I'm going to plug dietitians. That is not something that I recommend trying to do on your own. It can be a slippery slope, and there's a lot of misinformation out there that can lead us down some dark holes where it's not going to be beneficial for our health or performance. So if you are somebody who is wanting to make some changes to your nutrition to try to improve performance, I think that is fantastic. But I don't recommend trying to do that on your own by Googling or using social media. You know, if you are doing something like that, seeking out a reliable resource like a dietitian. So, you know, that's kind of why I created this podcast. I know that people are going to be searching for this information, and I want it to be a source of reliable information for all of you. But there are other dietitians who have fantastic podcasts and Instagrams and things like that. So just being a conscious consumer of where you're getting this nutrition advice, and if you're interested in starting that journey, I do encourage you to do so with support. So that said, kind of going back into the idea of this being Eating Disorder Awareness Week, and the fact that eating disorders and disordered eating as a whole impact athletes at such a disproportionate rate to non-athlete counterparts. I think there's a few reasons why that is, and I wanted to just talk about that a bit because, again, I think if athletes are struggling with this, they are likely to either try to pretend like it's not a problem or pretend like it's not a serious problem. And I think if you hear something in this that you resonate with, I do encourage you to maybe take a second look at your relationship with food and ask yourself, am I in a good place with this? Could I potentially benefit from some help? And I think for athletes, like I said, a couple factors. One is, I would say the biggest one that I see as a dietitian, especially in the endurance athlete community, there is this misconception that weighing less or looking a certain way is what's going to make you a better athlete. And of course, the first place people often go to with that thought is eating. And they say, well, I'm just going to eat less. I'm going to cut out dessert. I'm going to be really careful about what I'm eating. And again, it can start out with good intentions and it can initially work. It can initially make you a faster athlete. And I think that can be really confusing, especially for young athletes who might be seeing a friend or a teammate go through this. And they're noticing that this person's not taking care of themselves, but all of a sudden they're actually running faster, maybe even beating them. That's really hard to see. And it's confusing. And so then that athlete's like, well, maybe that's what I should be doing. Maybe I should be cutting these things out and watching what I'm eating. And that's sort of how that can create a poor team culture or a toxic environment. And Katie Rainsberger talked about this a little bit in her episode last week. So if you haven't listened to that one, I highly recommend going back to listen to it. But that is something that can be confusing. So I did want to break that down a little bit. Just because somebody is running well doesn't mean that they are healthy. And it doesn't mean that they are happy. And whatever they're doing, if they're not doing it the right way, it will catch up to them. There is not a single person who is an exception to that rule. There is never going to be somebody who can get away with underfueling forever. It will catch up to them. And it's really hard when that happens because a lot of times that athlete is in a bad place with their relationship with food, which impacts their ability to heal from an injury that will likely come up. And then it creates this vicious injury cycle that's really hard to break out of. And unfortunately, I've seen a lot of young athletes who were young phenoms and standouts from a young age go through this, get an injury, and unfortunately never really make it back. It's a sad reality of the sport, and it can be really difficult too at the collegiate level where it feels like there's just a replacement waiting. If you get injured, they can take your spot and it doesn't matter. So, you know, that's certainly part of it, is seeing another teammate or another athlete, comparing yourself to that person, and thinking maybe that's something that you need to be doing. I think another thing is our identity is really wrapped up in our body. You know, we work really hard as athletes and as runners. And I personally have never had a six pack. And when I was younger, that was really frustrating to me. I was like, I'm running so much, I'm doing all the right things. Why don't I have a six pack? And in my mind, having a six pack is what really would make me a successful runner. And eventually I, you know, going through all the schooling that I went through, learned that having a six pack is really genetic. And I don't have the genetics for a six pack. And that's okay. I've accepted that. I've moved on from making that a priority. And when I started focusing on other things, like how I was feeling and how I was recovering and, you know, things like that, that's when I saw big improvements in my performance. And I actually started beating people who had six packs. And so again, I think it's hard because we're taught, or we think that how we look impacts our performance and who we are as people. This is something I personally have encountered after retiring from elite running. My mileage looks different. My body is shifting a little bit. That can be hard. That can be a hard thing to go through. And it feels like you're losing your identity sometimes as a runner or as an athlete. And if I don't look like a runner, if I don't look like an athlete, then who's going to know that I was one, or who's going to know that I put in all that work? And, you know, it can sound silly, but it's really valid. It's something that a lot of us feel and fear. And so fear of body changes is a really big one for former athletes struggling with disordered eating, trying to hold on to that piece of their identity. That can be really hard. So, you know, I think it's really multifaceted with athletes who are struggling with eating disorders and disordered eating. But I really just want to emphasize here that you're not alone. If you're struggling with your relationship with food or body image, you're not alone. And you also don't need to suffer alone or in silence. There are so many resources out there. So I wanted to talk about some signs that an athlete in your life could potentially be struggling with food. I would say this might be more geared towards parents or coaches who are monitoring athletes. Some of the signs to look for in an athlete who may be struggling with their relationship with food or disordered eating: they start avoiding eating with other people. So maybe they're having dinner separately from their family. They're avoiding going to restaurants with their friends. Maybe they're lying about what they're eating. You notice that they come home, their lunchbox is full, even though they said they ate lunch. Or they're saying they're not hungry. even though they haven't really eaten much that day. Maybe they're avoiding foods that they used to love, or they claim things like, I'm just not a dessert person. This is a huge red flag for me with young athletes when they say, I just don't like sweet things. Everyone likes sweet things, okay? Maybe you don't like chocolate, or maybe you don't like specific sweet things, but that's just not true. Everybody likes something sweet sometimes. And that's not saying you have to eat dessert, but especially if you're noticing that your athlete or, you know, someone that is in your life who used to love those kinds of foods is avoiding them. I think that's kind of the key, is it's a change from usual behaviors. Avoiding social situations that involve food, so team dinners or going out with friends again. Sometimes dramatic weight changes, although not always. There's not always a weight change component to disordered eating. Noticing them changing as a person. So maybe they used to be really happy, bubbly, and outgoing, and now they're really struggling. They're snapping at you. They're more emotional. They just seem more down. Those can be some red flags as well. Becoming more isolated, so spending less time with friends and people that they love. Making more comments about their body, especially how they look in certain clothes, or, you know, they'll say, oh, I never noticed, you know, this, and they kind of pick apart their appearance a little bit more, or talking about people around them, like, wow, I wish I had her body, or wow, she looks really great. You know, occasional comments, fine, but if you're noticing a ton more of those, definitely something that could be a red flag. I'd say those are probably the main ones to look for, but I do think it's important to be aware of what some of those signs and symptoms can be. And if you resonated with any of those personally, or if you have an athlete in your life who you think meets a lot of those criteria, I know you're probably wondering, okay, well, what do I do? There's a lot of resources available, and I do encourage athletes to find athlete-specific resources. And some really great ones that I love, there is a website called Project Reds or Project Red S. Really, really great website with lots of information. They have practitioners on there that they recommend. Children's Hospital has a really great sports nutrition specific program in a lot of different states. I know Boston and Denver being two really big ones, and they have eating disordered and disordered eating help for adolescent and younger athletes. Fast Bananas is another great website that has some referrals. Running in Silence is another great website with information on how to find somebody to support you in this journey. And if you are struggling with an eating disorder and you need to seek treatment, you want to make sure that you have a complete care team. So you want to make sure there's a sports dietitian, a sports medicine physician, and some type of therapist as well. Those would kind of be the bare minimum, I would say. And there are athlete-specific eating disorder programs, and I really like these because I think sometimes that what can happen with general population eating disorder treatment is that you run into a situation where they're telling you to stop all activity altogether. And sometimes, yes, sometimes that is necessary, especially depending on the medical severity of what's going on, but it's not always necessary. And sometimes knowing that they're going to be getting back for a season or getting to do a run is what motivates athletes to recover. So I think it's important that as much as is medically safe to allow athletes to train to some capacity, not always as much as they used to train, but still do some type of training. So some really great athlete specific treatment options are programs like Athlete Edge, the Emily program, Side-by-Side Nutrition, etc. So just a quick discussion about eating disorders and disordered eating in athletes. I hope if you heard something on here that you resonate with, that you know that you're not alone, that your struggles are valid, and that it's really common. And, you know, I hope that you feel encouraged to seek help. You're going to be hearing from some athletes who have struggled with eating disorders here in the upcoming weeks. Allie Ostrander is one, and Amber Scholes is another, and they talk a little bit about their journey seeking recovery. So be sure to listen to those as well if that's something that you're interested in hearing about. Okay, let's dive into today's Q&A questions. One of my promises to the listeners of the Fueling Forward podcast is that I will never promote something unless I firmly believe in a brand and their product, have tried it myself, and feel like there is science to back it up. That's why I'm proud to partner with Momentous to bring you this episode. They invest in NSF certification, meaning every batch is tested for heavy metals, harmful additives, and label claim accuracy, and is the reason they're trusted by all 32 NFL teams and collegiate sports team dietitians all over the country. I personally use and love Momentous protein powder as a way to support my fueling and training goals. They also have a great post-workout recovery powder that has carbs and protein all in one. Not only does it taste great, but it actually blends well into things unlike other protein powders I've tried that taste gritty or chalky. Go to livemomentous.com and try it today at 20% off with code FUELINGFORWARD and start living on purpose. All right, starting out, we have, hello, I was wondering if you had any advice for food to prioritize while working on getting your period back, Peyton. Peyton, this is a great question, and I think this is a good segue from what I was talking about previously with eating disorders and disordered eating. So I think first and foremost, it's important to highlight the idea that an athlete losing their period is not normal. I've had several doctors for my younger athletes tell them that, oh, it's normal that you don't have your period. As soon as you're training less, it'll come back. That is not true. You should always have your period. I have been a high-level runner for 15 years. I've never once missed a period. And I think that's something that's important to share, especially, again, for parents and coaches. If you are hearing an athlete saying, I know it's normal, my pediatrician told me that it's normal, it's really not. And that's usually a sign that there's something going on with that energy balance like I mentioned earlier. And sometimes it's coming from that intentional piece, that disordered eating piece. And sometimes it's just coming from a lack of understanding of how much your body needs or just really struggling to eat enough. So there's a few things when it comes to period recovery that are most important. The first is, you know, obviously eating enough. And I know that's kind of vague and athletes get kind of frustrated when people tell them just eat more. And I agree. I know that's kind of a confusing, kind of broad suggestion. So the way in which you would want to go about eating more first is by making sure that you are eating 3 full meals a day. This is a big one for student athletes. I see a lot of young high school runners, especially, kind of like run out the door in the morning without eating breakfast or maybe just grabbing a bar. We definitely want to make sure that we're eating 3 full meals throughout the day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And at these meals, you want to make sure that about half of your plate is coming from carbohydrates and only about a quarter is coming from color, fruits or vegetables. So if we were to do, you know, like the size of your fist, about 2 fists of carbohydrates, 1 fist of color. Most young athletes I work with are doing the opposite. They're doing 2 fists of color and 1 fist of carbohydrates. The problem with that is we're not getting enough calories. We're getting too much fiber, and getting too much fiber can actually lower estrogen levels. And then we're also not getting enough carbohydrates. And carbohydrates are the other most important piece of the puzzle for period recovery because our body produces a hormone called insulin when we eat carbohydrates that raise our blood sugar. And insulin is directly tied to estrogen. So if our body is not producing much insulin because we're not eating much carbohydrates, it will lower your estrogen levels. So getting enough carbohydrates is the primary focus. And then the other component of your meals would be some type of protein, so about the size of your hand if it's a piece of meat, or the size of your fist if it's something like, you know, yogurt or shredded chicken, things like that. The other thing with period recovery is reducing what we call within day deficits. So this is the amount of time that you're spending between eating. And for high school or collegiate athletes, we want to keep this gap to about every 2 to 3 hours. We want to make sure that you're not going longer than 2 to 3 hours without eating. And research studies have shown that even if an athlete is eating enough calories, if they have longer gaps between their fueling, they are at a higher risk for loss of their period or RET. So it's not just about how much you're eating, it's about when you're eating as well. And then the last piece to that would definitely be managing stress. And this comes from both a training aspect and a life aspect. If you're training too much, your body experiences high levels of stress. It's going to generate a stress response. And our bodies perceive all forms of stress the exact same way. Our body will mount the same response regardless of where the stress is coming from. So if that's physical stress, then our body will do the same thing as if we're stressed out about a test. So if we're overtraining, that puts our body into a state of constant stress. And stress alone can impact the menstrual cycle. So there was a research study done on young runners who had lost their period, and they had all of them go to therapy to work on stress management skills. 8 out of 10 of those people got their periods back without changing anything else. So managing stress is a huge part of maintaining a regular cycle. But for athletes, there is that added consideration of training load. So making sure that if you don't have a period, you talk to your coach about taking one day off a week or doing a cross training day or a lower volume day. That can make a huge difference. If you do have a lot of life stress going on, seeking help from a therapist, trying something like journaling or meditation, making sure you're getting enough sleep, you know, all those things feed into stress levels. So those are the places that I would recommend starting. If you are somebody who's trying to get your period back, highly recommend reaching out to a dietitian to help you navigate that challenge, and also to make sure that you do see a medical professional just to rule out anything else that may be going on instead of trying to, you know, self-diagnose. So that would be my suggestion for anyone who's trying to get their period back. Thank you, Peyton, for that question. Okay, this next question is sort of a good build off of Peyton's question. This question says, should people who menstruate fuel or hydrate differently if racing in the days before or during their period? Are we more likely to have GI issues before or during our period? I'm mostly interested in mid-race fueling, but any pre-race meal or snack tips are good too. Super great question, and this is something that I feel most females in general, menstruating people in general, are not educated on. I didn't learn anything about what my menstrual cycle looked like or, you know, if there were any special considerations, so I do think this is something that I wish more of us knew. A couple considerations, the week before your period. So we have essentially two phases of our menstrual cycle. We have the follicular phase, which is the first half of our cycle. This is considered the low hormone phase. So we're a little bit more physiologically similar to men during this phase. The second half of our cycle is called the luteal phase, and this is the high hormone phase. So in this phase, this is when we tend to see more performance disruptions or, you know, symptoms of how we're feeling. And that's not to say that you're automatically going to struggle with performance if you have a race or a big workout in that phase. That's half of every month, which is half of the year for you know, female athletes. So it's not something that you need to be concerned about, but there are some considerations if you're noticing symptoms that are impacting you. The first is hydration. So we actually are at a greater risk for dehydration and electrolyte imbalances in that second phase of the cycle. So something that you can try out is just increasing your fluids a little bit, adding an extra serving of electrolytes, especially pre-run. That's certainly something that can help. Another thing with that is our core temperature is slightly higher. So we have increased metabolism, which means we're burning more fuel. We also are at an increased risk for things like overheating during a training session. So again, adding more hydration, adding more electrolytes pre-run can kind of help mitigate some of those symptoms. And from a carbohydrate standpoint, we do have a little bit of a harder time accessing energy stores. So what you can try is just having a little bit more carbohydrates before your runs during that second half of your cycle. And I will say personally, I didn't really make any of these changes because I never noticed a very significant difference, but I have some athletes that I work with who do. And if that is you, if you're noticing like consistently there's a week where you're just feeling more tired or struggling more on runs, these are some things you can try out to see if it makes a difference. And in terms of the during race or run fueling, if you are in that luteal phase, the second half of your cycle, considering adding, you know, an extra gel. So maybe you're taking a gel every 40 minutes, and during this phase, maybe you try to take one every 30 to 35 minutes. So it's not a huge increase, but it's enough to help mitigate any of that physiological response going on that might impact how you're feeling or how you're performing. This is a fun fact and something I didn't know until I studied nutrition and sports nutrition specifically. We actually physiologically can perform our best on our period. I grew up in high school thinking that if I had my period for a race, I was doomed. It was going to be a horrible race. And that's actually not true. Physiologically speaking, we can actually perform our best during our cycle. So that's just something to reassure you that it's okay if you have a big race coming up and you're on your period, you're not doomed. You actually might have a fantastic day. Okay, the next question says, I really appreciated your answer about structuring fueling. In that, you said you don't recommend runners tracking calories because it doesn't allow them to listen to their bodies. What if your doctor is telling you to lose weight? Is there a safe way to lose weight or track nutrients for medical reasons while continuing to run and train? Mariah. Mariah, this is a fantastic question, and I think it's multifaceted in that the first question is, why is your doctor telling you to lose weight? Is it medically necessary? Is it something that you need to do to improve your health? The answer is not always. And there's something called the Health at Every Size movement. If you're not familiar with this, this is a great thing to look up because there are certain practitioners that are actually certified in this movement. But the idea behind it is that there are people who just exist in larger bodies and there's no medical need for them to lose weight. They're actually very healthy, especially when you're looking at things like blood work, blood pressure. Everything looks great. The only thing is that kind of quote-unquote BMI that tells you whether you're, you know, overweight, obese. And that's, we're sort of moving away from using BMI as a marker of health because it really isn't a good one. It doesn't really indicate somebody's true risk for medical instances. So I think that's kind of the first thing that you could potentially challenge your doctor on is this medically necessary? Is this really something that I need to do to improve my health? Or is it just because my BMI classifies me in a category that, you know, historically speaking, doctors would tell me to lose weight? If there is a health component to it, you know, I would say that depending on your goals with training, it can be difficult to chase those two goals at the same time. So it's not always possible to chase performance goals while chasing weight loss goals because the things that you need to do for those two things are very different. That said, you know, of course, if you are somebody who is needing to reduce their weight for medical reasons, increasing your activity level by running a little bit more is a great way to do that. You know, making sure that you're staying active and actually eating enough, which is a huge thing that I think a lot of people who are trying to lose weight don't do. They restrict too much. They put themselves in too much of a calorie deficit. And this actually puts their body into that survival mode where it slows down metabolism, it holds on to fuel, it's losing muscle mass, it's storing more fat mass, which is really just working against those goals. So even if your goal is weight loss for medical reasons, you know, it's actually pretty similar to what I've said before. You do want to make sure that you're eating three meals a day. You do want to make sure that you're eating between meals with balanced snacks to help keep your metabolism up and to prevent that extreme hunger from going into a meal and overeating because you're too hungry, because it's been too long without eating. You know, somebody who is running and medically focused on reducing their weight, things would look a little bit different than somebody who is, let's say, training for a marathon and trying to optimize their performance. So I think that's the biggest takeaway. But in terms of, you know, again, numbers and restriction, it's not as extreme as I think we've all been taught that it is. And again, it's not always necessary for us to shrink our body. So just a couple asides for anyone in that position. Okay, this next question is maybe a little more medical focused. So I want to preface this by saying this is not medical advice, but this is something that I see a lot in my practice. And I think that it's a very common experience that I would love to talk a little bit more about what I personally do in my practice. So this question comes from Liz. Liz says, in 2023, I was diagnosed with SIBO, which stands for small intestinal bacteria overgrowth. After about 14 months of going through every type of doctor out there and being told I was healthy and just needed more sleep, while the sleep part is true, that didn't solve my joint pain, bloating, and GI distress until a local acupuncturist recommended I ask my gastro for a SIBO test. I've cut so much quote-unquote regular food out of my diet, things like gluten, dairy, many high FODMAP foods like garlic and onion, And as somebody who has struggled in the body image, orthorexia, amenorrhea world, this has really wreaked havoc on my mental state. I know I feel better, many of my symptoms have improved, but sometimes I feel like if I eat another sweet potato, I'll throw up. I understand I'll probably have to make some lifelong adjustments to my diet. Guess I can't eat cheesy pasta every night for dinner. But when I ran my marathon PR and BQ in 2017, I was living a whole milk, high carb, whole food lifestyle that seemed to work, and I want to get back to a place where I don't need to spend so much energy reading ingredients, researching menus, and generally finding social joy in meals again. Help. Liz, this is such a difficult thing to go through, and I first want to say that I'm sorry that this is something that you're experiencing. I know it's really hard to navigate chronic GI issues, and on top of that, feeling kind of that fear around food in a different sense. And I know it can be even more challenging if you have a history of struggling with disordered eating, you know, body image issues, losing your period. So I definitely just want to validate your struggles here and just let you know that I know this is really hard. And I think a common theme that I hear from a lot of athletes that I work with who are going through some type of health crisis or medical symptoms is that a doctor is telling them that everything looks normal. That is the most frustrating thing that somebody can hear when they don't feel good and they're having symptoms. And to me, as a practitioner, my priority is your symptoms. Tests don't tell us the whole story all the time. Symptoms are really what's important here. And there's a lot of different things that can influence symptoms, but I think what I see a lot in the medical realm is with blood work especially, there is such a large range that it's interpreted through that it's not appropriate for every person. You know, ferritin, for example, the ranges that they give you as normal on a lab test sheet is anywhere from, say, 15 to 150. If I have an athlete whose ferritin is below 30 and they have symptoms of low iron, I'm going to address that. If I have an athlete whose ferritin is over 100 and they have other issues happening, that tells me there's some inflammation and we need to address that. So it's not as simple as just these wide ranges. And the other thing is the ranges that we see on those lab test sheets are often coming from an average of the general population going to that lab. So cholesterol readings, for example, might be interpreted differently in Boulder, Colorado than somewhere in rural Oklahoma. And that's important to distinguish too, is that the way your doctor is applying your personal lab work to those ranges is not always appropriate. And I personally prefer to use something that I call a functional range. So this is a much tighter range where our body has been shown to operate at its best from a physiological standpoint. And that's going to look different for every single person. And symptoms should always trump lab results. If you are really struggling and you don't feel like yourself and you have all these symptoms going on, it doesn't matter if your lab work looks quote unquote normal. That probably means we didn't do the right lab work or there's more things that we need to test. So kudos to you, Liz, for advocating for yourself to get more testing done. I know that's really hard and I wish people didn't have to do that so often in our healthcare system. Again, Katie Rainsberger last week talked about her personal experience with that, ending up having a tumor that took almost a year to get diagnosed. So it's really frustrating to experience that. And I think as athletes, especially, we are so in tune with our body and how we feel that it almost happens more often in athletes where we know what it feels like to feel good and we know what it feels like to not feel good. And we're much more aware of when that shift happens. So I think good job advocating for yourself. And with any type of GI issue, usually there's, again, it's pretty multifaceted. And I personally, I like to run a test on my athletes who have GI issues called a GI map. So this is a test that sort of looks at overall GI health, including things like intestinal overgrowth of bacteria, which is what you had mentioned, Liz, SIBO, digestive insufficiency, any type of inflammation, overactive immune system, leaky gut, where we have a lot of gaps in the tight junctions that are supposed to keep things in our gut that are now escaping out into our bloodstream and causing reactions. So there's a lot of different components of a GI map that I like to look at. And SIBO, or the intestinal overgrowth, tends to be a symptom rather than the problem itself. So like you had said earlier, Liz, you used to be able to eat all these foods. And what I tend to see in athletes who experience changes in GI problem is that it's coming from, there was something that sort of tipped their body into the state of no longer being able to maintain gut health on its own. If we are producing enough digestive enzymes and we have the right amount of stomach acid, then typically we can keep our gut bacteria in check. You know, we always want to have gut bacteria there, but if it overgrows or if we don't have enough of it, that's when we can tend to have some problems. So for a lot of athletes that I work with, intestinal overgrowth starts with digestive insufficiency. We don't have enough stomach acid to control overgrowth. We also have, you know, low digestive enzymes and things like that. So now we have all this food that's not digesting well, sitting in our GI tract, and it's feeding all of these bad bacteria. They have more of an opportunity to overgrow because now they're getting more food and there's less stomach acid controlling the overgrowth. And that sort of creates this vicious cycle within the gut that then increases inflammation and suppresses our gut's immune system, which is also something that helps fight the overgrowth. So then it's just sort of burnt out, and now we're having all these reactions to food that we never used to have, you know, because this inflammation is damaging the gut lining. So now we're seeing gaps in those tight junctions. So now we're having those food proteins leak out into the bloodstream where they're not supposed to be yet. So we're having all these reactions. So I say that, you know, SIBO, of course, is a problem, and it's something that needs to be treated, but it usually is coming from something else. And if we have digestive insufficiency as an athlete, my first concern is mineral support. So we need to make sure we have enough sodium to improve our stomach acid production and adequate fueling. We have to make sure we're eating enough and eating enough protein to make those digestive enzymes so we can digest well. This is part of the reason why another symptom of REDS is increased stomach issues, because we're no longer able to produce enough digestive enzymes. We've lowered our digestive capacity. So when I'm working with somebody who has SIBO, one of the first things we work on is improving digestive capacity. Then we work on addressing that overgrowth, and then we work on repopulating the gut with beneficial bacteria, rebalancing it, kind of resealing that damaged gut tissue and reducing that inflammation so that the gut's able to maintain its health on its own. And most of the time, when we resolve those issues, you can actually start reintroducing some of those foods that caused problems and not have any issues. I would say that's kind of the last piece of my answer is, if you used to be able to eat those foods without a problem and now you have a problem, it's probably not those foods. It's probably the way that your gut health is changing. So if you are noticing those symptoms, definitely encourage you to, you know, kind of do what Liz did, advocate for yourself, get further GI testing, especially a GI map. That's one of the most effective forms of testing for gut health. You know, working with a practitioner who understands athletes, especially who's looking at things in a tighter range. So functional medicine is another good key word to look for in your search. Functional nutrition, that's something that I incorporate into my practice as well. So just really making sure that you are finding a provider who understands the nuances of individualizing this kind of approach. I had to laugh too, Liz, when you said, if you eat another sweet potato, you think you'll throw up. I think that can be a point that a lot of athletes who can't eat gluten get to. So I think as much as possible too, trying to keep the foods that you can eat exciting and not just sticking to the same things over and over. So other naturally gluten-free foods, oats, those are really versatile. You can make your own granola bars. You can make baked oatmeal, overnight oats. You can make energy bites. Rice is a great one. You can make rice, homemade rice cakes. You can make a sweet version of rice with things like soy milk or almond milk and some vanilla and sweetener and cinnamon. You know, trying to keep things exciting in that way. Finding gluten-free options for cereals, for granolas, for crackers. Nut Thins are a really great example. Just trying to find some diversity within the constraints of what you're able to eat can also help make things more exciting. You know, I would say a regular potato instead of sweet potatoes, that's perfectly fine. There's actually no difference in nutritional value between the two. The only difference is that sweet potatoes have more vitamin A from the orange color. So, you know, again, you don't have to do the sweet potatoes. You could do regular potatoes. So just trying your best to get creative with the types of foods you are able to incorporate while you're working on gut health and working towards a solution where you're not going to have to avoid these foods forever. Thank you guys so much for listening to today's episode of the Fueling Forward podcast, Q&A with me, your host, Maddie Alm, registered dietitian and former elite runner. Next week's episode is going to be an interview with professional runner Allie Ostrander, where she shares her experiences with eating disorder treatment as a high-level runner and ultimately going on to qualify for the Olympic trials. Her story is super inspiring, and I really hope that you enjoy it. So please make sure to tune in. Again, if you want to submit questions for the next Q&A, you can do so on my website at www.fuelingforward.com under the podcast tab, or you can email me at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you with the next Fueling Forward Friday.